Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. I'm going to be reading Majjhima Nikaya 28. This is Mahāhāti Padopamma Sutta, also known as the Greater Discourse on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. This is a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Friends, bhikkhus." "Friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this: "Friends, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed within an elephant's footprint, and so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size, so too all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths." "What four?" "In what four?" "In the noble truth of suffering, in the noble truth of the origin of suffering, in the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and in the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering." "And what is the noble truth of suffering?" "Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering." "And what are the five aggregates affected by clinging?" "They are the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging." "And what is the material form aggregate affected by clinging?" "It is the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements." "And what are the four great elements?" "They are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element." "What, friends, is the earth element?" "The earth element may be either internal or external." "What is the internal earth element?" "Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to, that is, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element." Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus: "This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself." When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate toward the earth element. Now, there comes a time when the water element is disturbed, and then the external earth element vanishes. When even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus: "This painful feeling born of your contact has arisen in me. That is dependent, not independent." "Dependent on what?" "Dependent on contact." Then he sees that contact is impermanent. That feeling is impermanent. That perception is impermanent. That formations are impermanent. And that consciousness is impermanent. And his mind, having made an element its objective support, enters into that new objective support and acquires confidence, steadiness, and resolution. Now, if others attack that bhikkhu in ways that are unwished for, undesired, and disagreeable, by contact with fists, clods, sticks, or knives, he understands thus, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. But this has been said by the Blessed One in his advice on the simile of the saw. Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. So tireless energy shall be aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established. My body shall be tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. And now let contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail this body. For this teaching of the Buddhas is being practiced by me. When that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency thus, it is a loss for me, it is no gain for me, it is bad for me, it is no good for me that when I thus recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in me. Just as when a daughter-in-law sees her father-in-law, she arouses a sense of urgency to please him, so too when that bhikkhu thus recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, if equanimity supported by the wholesome does not become established in him, then he arouses a sense of urgency. But if when he recollects the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, equanimity supported by the wholesome becomes established in him, then he is satisfied with it. At that point, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. What, friends, is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What is the internal water element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery and clung to. That is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery and clung to. This is called the internal water element. Now, both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees this thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate toward the water element. Now there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed. It carries away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean sink down 100 leagues, 200 leagues, 300 leagues, 400 leagues, 500 leagues, 600 leagues, 700 leagues. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 7 palms deep, 6 palms deep, 5 palms deep, 4 palms deep, 3 palms deep, 2 palms deep, only a palm deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 7 fathoms deep, 6 fathoms deep, 5 fathoms deep, 4 fathoms deep, 3 fathoms deep, 2 fathoms deep, only a fathom deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean stand 0.5 fathom deep, only waist deep, only knee deep, only ankle deep. There comes a time when the waters in the great ocean are not enough to wet even the joint of a finger. When even this external water element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus. And at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. What, friends, is the fire element? The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery and clung to. That is that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. Or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. This is called the internal fire element. Now, both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply fire element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the fire element and makes the mind dispassionate toward the fire element. Now there comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed. It burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. It goes out due to lack of fuel only when it comes to green grass or to a road or to a rock or to water or to a fair open space. There comes a time when they seek to make a fire even with a cock's feather or a hide paring. When even this external fire element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change. What of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus. And at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. What, friends, is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy and clung to. That is upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breath and out-breath, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Now, both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate toward the air element. Now there comes a time when the external air element is disturbed. It sweeps away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. There comes a time in the last month of the hot season when they seek wind by means of a fan or bellows, and even the strands of straw in the drip fringe of the thatch do not stir. When even this external air element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, What of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering that as I or mine or I am. So then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu who has seen this element as it actually is, he understands thus. And at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Friends, just as when a space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be termed just house. So too, when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed just material form. If, friends, internally the eye is intact, but no external forms come into its range, and there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. If internally the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. But when internally the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, and there is the corresponding conscious engagement, then there is the manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. The material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form aggregate affected by clinging. The feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations in what has thus come to be are included in the formations aggregate affected by clinging. The consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, gathering, and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. Now this has been said by the Blessed One. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And these five aggregates affected by clinging are dependently arisen. The desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding based on these five aggregates affected by clinging is the origin of suffering. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging is the cessation of suffering. At that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. If, friends, internally the ear is intact, but no external sounds come into its range, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. If, friends, internally the nose is intact, but no external smells come into its range, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. If, friends, internally the tongue is intact, but no external flavors come into its range, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. If, friends, internally the body is intact, but no external tangibles come into its range, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. If, friends, internally the mind is intact, but no external mind objects come into its range, and there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. If internally the mind is intact and external mind objects come into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. But when internally the mind is intact and external mind objects come into its range and there is a corresponding conscious engagement, then there is the manifestation of the corresponding section of consciousness. The material form in what has thus come to be is included in the material form aggregate affected by clinging. The feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate affected by clinging. The formations in what has thus come to be are included in the formations aggregate affected by clinging. The consciousness in what has thus come to be is included in the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. He understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, gathering, and amassing of things into these five aggregates affected by clinging. Now this has been said by the Blessed One. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And these five aggregates affected by clinging are thus dependently arisen. The desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding based on these five aggregates affected by clinging is the origin of suffering. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging is the cessation of suffering. At that point, too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. This is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. So this sutta is a wonderful and brilliant analysis of the Four Noble Truths and an elaboration of them. Sariputta declares that the Four Noble Truths are the be-all, end-all of the Dhamma. Within the Four Noble Truths is contained everything that one requires in order to liberate the mind and to break the bonds of samsara. He analyzes the First Noble Truth according to what is usually talked about in terms of what is suffering. Birth is suffering, death is suffering, old age is suffering, not getting what one wants is suffering, being detached from what one wants is suffering, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, the end statement of that First Noble Truth, which is that the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. And then he takes, well, first he states each of the five aggregates, and then he takes the form aggregate, the material form aggregate, and then he deciphers what form is and elaborates on what form is. In that time, during the Buddha's time, and around ancient India, the understanding was that there are the four great elements. Sometimes there are six. The first four are always the same, which is earth, water, fire, air, and then there's sometimes space and the consciousness element. But in this case, Sariputta is now describing what is the material form and what it is comprised of. And he talks about it in the context of the four great elements of ancient Indian thought. If we were to bring this into contemporary understanding as one sees it, it is attributable to the four states of matter. Earth being the solid state of matter, water being the liquid state of matter, air being the gaseous state of matter, and fire being the plasma state of matter. And if we were to take a look at this body, this material form, it encompasses all of the solid matter in the form of what Sariputta describes as the skin, the bones, the muscles, the sinews, the joints, the teeth, the nails, the organs, and so on and so forth. Likewise, we can see that the blood and the different liquid materials within the body are the water element or the liquid state of matter. And then the different courses of air that move around the body, the different courses of air that move around the stomach, the digestive system, and so on, is comparable to the gaseous state of matter. And the way I see the plasma state of matter is the electrical circuitry that is in our neurons and in our nervous system. So one can see this in the updated form as well, that all of these different elements of the body, whether that you see it from the four great elements or the four states of matter, are nonetheless not sentient. They're insentient, they are impersonal, and they have no life to them, no vitality to them, if there was no consciousness there. So the states of matter in the body, or the elements that make up the body, are one and the same in the way of understanding with the external elements or the states of matter around us in the universe that we experience, in this reality that we experience. So there is no real difference between the materials of this body on a chemical, biological, organic, and inorganic state of being with that of the elements of the universe. So in that case, when one experiences anything in the way of sensory feelings, sensory experiences, through the eyes, through the ears, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body or the skin, or through the mind, one should see it as dependent upon the materials that make up the sixth sense bases, that make up the mentality and materiality, that make up this physicality of the body. The physical eyes, the physical ears, the physical nose, the physical tongue, the physical body, and the mind from which we experience the thoughts that are the circuitry of the brain, the physical matter of the brain. And when one sees this, one understands that if contact arises dependent upon these things, which have no inherent sense of self in them, which are impersonal, and is dependent upon these things which continually change in the way of cellular change, in the way of metabolic change, in the way of atomic change, in the way that our eyes weaken as we age, our ears weaken as we age, and so on and so forth. If that contact is dependent upon those sort of sixth sense bases, which they are, then the sensory experiences that arise in the way of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking are also impermanent Because the moment these physical sense bases are no longer present, so too will the sensory experiences not be present. So in that, we have to see that the sensory experiences that one feels, that one has, the feeling in the links of dependent origination, or the feeling aggregate, is also impermanent, is also not worth holding on to, subject to change, subject to dissolution, and so should not be considered as self, should not be considered as possessing a sense of inherent self. And along with perception, you have, along with feeling, you have perception. So perception is conjoined with feeling. And if perception arises or core arises with feeling, in the same way as feeling being dependent upon contact, which is dependent upon the six sense bases, which are all impermanent and therefore not worth holding on to and not to be considered to be self, then we should understand perception in the same way. Perception being the part of the mind, the faculty and process of the mind that recognizes, that recognizes what is being felt, what is being experienced, what is being seen or heard or smelled or tasted or touched or thought about. It provides the understanding based on what one has learned previously and based in memory. So this perception too continually changes. If we broaden the idea of perception as being part of what one considers to be the views one holds, let's say, based on what one has learned and gathered up and aggregated through knowledge gathering, through learning, and through the words of one's elders and friends, these perceptions too change based on the person that goes through various kinds of evolution. The perception of one thing might be different than the perception of what one had a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or even when one was a child. So perceptions are fickle, just like feeling, just like contact, just like the sixth sense base. Then you have formations. Formations are dependent upon contact. They are activated by contact. They are conditioned by ignorance in one who is not fully released, but they arise dependent upon karma, dependent upon contact. And these formations, when they arise, they then activate a certain kind of consciousness. So the formations that arise, arise in less than a microsecond, arise very quickly, and then continue on to influence the consciousness and so on. But because they are impermanent, because they arise dependent upon other factors, causes, and conditions, they should not be, and they cannot be considered to be self. They cannot be considered to be me, mine, or myself. And then consciousness itself is dependent upon the sensory experiences one has. Consciousness arises dependent upon the contact and the feeling. So there is, as Sariputta talks about, the conscious engagement. He talks about the physical sixth sense bases being intact and their various sensory experiences, the external senses, sensory experiences tied to each of the sixth sense bases, coming into range, For example, one sees the light and it comes into range. But if there is no conscious engagement of that corresponding consciousness, which means that there has to be an intention of attention, that means that the factors of intention and attention, the faculties of intention and attention, are being processed and carry forward that conscious engagement to be able to see that light, to have that sensory experience. And then that intention will then drive forward either craving or unremitting mindfulness, as Sariputta talks about, meaning one could get carried away by the visual form, delight in it, and take it to be a sense of self, or being attractive to a sense of self and attached to it, or have aversion towards that visual form, have distaste towards it, and then have the idea that it is aversive, it is distasteful, it is disgusting to a sense of self. In either case, the sense of self has arisen or just merely identifies with that visual form. Then that craving is present, and that craving arises through one or more of the five aggregates and the experience of the five aggregates. It is the clinging aspect of the five aggregates, these five aggregates affected by clinging, that need to be seen and that need to be let go of in the way of clinging to them. And that is done through awareness and mindfulness, through proper attention in whatever is being experienced through the five aggregates. One needs to understand that it is just a series of impersonal phenomena that is arising. It is a series of impersonal, impermanent phenomena that are made up of one or more of the elements or states of matter. And so there is no sentience to them. There is no sense of self, a consciousness to them. They are just arising dependent upon causes and conditions. And when they come into the range of the field of the six sense bases, and there is conscious engagement with them, then at that point, there needs to also be sharp mindfulness so that one understands that whatever is arising is to be taken as impersonal, impermanent, and not worth holding on to. And so if that happens, then one stops the flow of dependent origination at that point. Then one stops that craving from arising, that clinging from arising, that bhava or being from arising, that birth from arising, and then the suffering from arising. And so if at any point this feeling that arises, the sensory experience that arises, is taken as self, or there is craving present through one of the five aggregates or the experience that is occurring through one or more of the five aggregates, and if that arises, one needs to see it with mindfulness. And how does that happen? It is through the understanding of the Eightfold Path. So here in the Sutta, Sariputta talks about the five aggregates and the craving that arises from them and the craving for them, which is the origin of suffering. And rightly so, because once one craves, personalizes, and takes any of these five aggregates to be permanent and a sense of self, creating that craving, then that will then create the clinging, that will then create the being, that will then create the birth of action rooted in yukama, and then that will create suffering. So this is the origin of suffering, taking any of these five aggregates as sense of self, with a sense of self. Then he talks about the second noble truth being that craving for them that arises, the origin of that. And then he talks about the cessation, which is the abandoning and removal of the craving. This is done through the Eightfold Path. Although he doesn't mention it, it is quite implicit within the sutta, and it should be understood thus that it is the Eightfold Path that is the way to the cessation of suffering. And that starts with, obviously, right view. That is, first and foremost, not subscribing to an eternalist view or a nihilistic or annihilationism view, which still considers to be a sense of self in there. And then there is the mundane view, which begins with understanding that there is action and consequence. There is cause and consequence. There is benefit in giving, in being generous. There is a debt of gratitude that one owes to one's parents or those who have brought one up. There is the world that exists now, and there is worlds beyond this world. There are worlds beyond this world. That's the mundane right view. The super mundane right view is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths and seeing them in every moment of every phenomenon that arises and passes away. Then this gives rise to right intention. Right intention being the intention of letting go, of renunciation, of having the idea that there is nothing worth holding on to, and whatever is being held on to should be let go of, should be understood as attachments that need to be let go of. And there is the intention of non-ill will and non-cruelty, not to engage in actions and speech that would create in oneself or in others ill will or a sense of harmfulness. And so the cultivation of loving kindness, the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is quite important in order to understand this intention and to actually exercise this right intention. And then that naturally spills over into right speech and right action and right livelihood. Right speech being not using false speech, not using harsh speech, not using divisive speech, not engaging in idle chatter. Right action being refraining from ill will and intentionally harming anyone in mind, body, or speech. Refraining from taking what is not given. Refraining from stealing, essentially. And refraining from sexual misconduct. Right livelihood is that livelihood that contributes to peace, that contributes to the well-being of others. Doesn't snatch away the possibility of another's potential to gain liberation or to access liberation. And so right livelihood is that which is peaceful and bears fruit through peace and with peace and bears fruit in peace. And then this goes into right effort, which is the 6R process as one understands it. The 4 right efforts. When one understands the 4 right efforts, then mindfulness can naturally arise. The 4 right efforts being preventing the unwholesome states from arising, abandoning already arisen unwholesome states, then bringing up wholesome states, and then maintaining those wholesome states. This happens, obviously, in the meditation process and through the 6 R's. When you prevent unwholesome states from arising, you do so by recognizing when the mind is distracted by one or more of the 5 hindrances. When you release and relax, you are abandoning and letting go of the hindrances that are already present in the mind and the craving and tension attached to them. When you come back to your smile or re-smile, you are bringing up the wholesome state of mind, starting with the enlightenment factor of joy. And then when you maintain that by coming back to your object of meditation, you inevitably and quite effectively start to bring up the other factors of awakening. You are activating them every time you do the six-hour process. And so this is right effort, and this goes into mindfulness. And mindfulness means having the awareness of the present in terms of where one's mind is in relation to the body, in relation to sensory experiences, in relation to the mind itself and the mental states within that mind. And one is mindfulness, one develops mindfulness and one is mindful in order to see if there is any craving or aversion present. To that extent, one utilizes mindfulness and comes back to the present awareness of the body, the feelings, the mind, and mental states. By exercising this mindfulness in this way, one is practicing the recognition step, strengthening the mindfulness through recognizing what is occurring in the mind when one continues to meditate. When one is meditating, one accesses one or more of the jhanas and then the higher levels of perception. And so these encompass the Eightfold Path. When one utilizes the Eightfold Path through this understanding and effectively exercises them, one then has the cessation of suffering by rooting out the craving that might have arisen, or rooting out even the potential for craving to arise, and staying in a mind that is free of craving, that is free of suffering. And so when one attains arahatship, then that unlocks the right knowledge, the effective insight into the understanding that the mind is liberated. And so there is right liberation in where the mind is immersed in that nibbana. So that is the fruit of the practice. And this is how it should be understood, that one has to see that everything around oneself and everything that is comprised of the body, the material aggregates, the form aggregates, the form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate are all impersonal, are all impermanent, and should not be held onto. And it is through these that there is the potential for craving to arise if one does not exercise right mindfulness, if one does not exercise the awareness and proper attention to what is arising, and considering that all that arises is not me, not mine, not myself. When one does this, one has let go of the craving and one has let go of the potential for craving. If it has arisen, one lets it go, but then also one lets go the potential for the craving from then having arisen. It will not arise. And so when this happens, one is naturally in a place of what one can say is a mundane nibbana, a peaceful state of mind, void of craving, void of any attachments, void of any personalizations, and void of any ignorance, because one has properly exercised the Four Noble Truths in this manner. Any questions?
Hi, Delson.
Hello.
This sutta also refers to loving kindness and the simile of the saw. And a question that comes up many times and times in people is, how should one engage socially when you see things that are not fair or that should be changed? I noticed that in many communities there is great discussion in either one should take care of their own practice versus one should do good in the world and engage and in politics or whatever. And I would like your view on it.
So the way I see it is, we should always first create a foundation in the mind for loving kindness, for compassion, for joy and equanimity. In other words, develop the Brahmaviharas. We start off from that, and then at that point we can engage in a manner that is effective and in alignment with the Dhamma. And when we engage with the world, it is for the sake of providing peace to the world, for the sake of providing peace of mind to people who might not have peace of mind, to resolve conflicts if it is possible. And I mean that on a personal level. So it starts with oneself, then it continues on with one's family, with one's friends. But the idea of engaging in politics and so on, one can do that so long as one is a lay person and has the intention of doing that. But as far as I know from the suttas, the Buddha talks about where one should, as a monk, one should not engage in politics. But as lay people, one can, or as a lay person, one can definitely utilize the principles of the Dhamma in such a way that it can create some sort of positive influence for one's community and an at-large society, if possible. We see this happening in different ways that are not necessarily rooted in the complete understanding of the Dhamma, but when we look at history, there have been figures in history, in modern history, for example, you have Martin Luther King and Gandhi, who utilized nonviolence, who utilized the right intention of letting go and not engaging in ill will or cruelty or violence, and were able to make some kind of change, at least for the foreseeable future in their generation and so on. They made their impact on history by utilizing such principles. So in the way I see it is, it always begins with ourselves. It always begins with first establishing that loving kindness in ourselves, which then we can first and foremost radiate to others, and then engage consciously, engage actively through that mindset of loving kindness, through that mindset of not having ill will.
Hey, Dasan.
Hello.
I probably want to take this opportunity again. So this sutta is really good example that is showing the interrelationship between the links of dependent origination and the five aggregates.
Yeah.
And what Sariputta is saying, these five aggregates are dependently originated, not independently originated. So these five aggregates are really the product of the flow or the dependent origination. And only, so they are a reason that they arise because of the conscious engagement. They do not arise if there is no engagement. So that engagement, what that engagement is this our inclination, our craving, our desire? Why do they arise? So this is kind of, would you be able to expand on this one?
Yeah. It's the conscious engagement is the intention. It starts first and foremost with the intention, which then pays attention, the intention to pay attention to what is arising. Now, when one does that, then you have to then see if there is any craving arising from that. When there's conscious engagement, there can be either craving or there can just be the present understanding that this is here right now. There is present this particular sensation or this particular perception or whatever it might be. And then also have the understanding through correct mindfulness and correct understanding that this is impersonal and impermanent. So obviously at that point, with that sort of intention or that sort of attention, there is no clinging or craving for what is arising.
Hello, Dilson.
Hello.
Hi. I am seeing this sutta in another perspective, that when it was talking about the wind, fire, water, it was talking about the changes happening outside of the in the environment. So I feel like sometimes like when we see some situation is happening, like some wildfire is happening or some sea levels are changing, if we become too emotional with that, like, and we become angry maybe sometimes, that can cause trouble to us. How do you see this in terms of, like, what is your perspective in terms of, like, seeing these kind of things happening outside with respect to five aggregates?
Yeah, so, yeah, it's interesting because Sariputta talks about the fire and about water, for example, which is in the current environment, and if things continue the way that they are going, that there will be a lack of the resource of water. And so there will be problems there. And so there can be wars and fighting and all kinds of things that might arise from the scarcity of water, for example. Or when you see these natural disasters arising that can create tragedies for people because of untimely death or whatever it might be. When one sees all of this, let's say on the news, what one has to first consider is this actually in one's control at the moment? You can't do anything about it in terms of changing what has already arisen. But in the way of creating for oneself or preventing from this arising again, there is the practical approach to seeing it and then implementing certain things that can help to prevent that from arising again. And this has been done in some ways or another for preventing wildfires, for example. But in terms of seeing this in the news or hearing about it, what first needs to be understood is what arises in the way of emotions when one sees it or one hears about it. So first and foremost, you need to see for yourself if there is any kind of, as you mentioned, anger or discontentment or frustration that arises. That can then give rise to further craving, and then that can give rise to further clinging and so on. So first you see if that's present, let go of it and come back to a more balanced state of mind. If there is the intention of doing something, the intention of doing something about it and changing it, let it come from a wiser perspective rather than a reactive perspective, rather than coming from anger, understanding that this causes destruction. And there, if there are the capabilities in oneself to do something about it, then do so from a mind that is balanced, that is more harmonious, and that is rooted in a perspective of Dhamma.
Thank you, Dilson.
Okay, let's share some merit.
May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired, for the acquisitions of all kinds of happiness. May being inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.